don't fear me, because I know what I want. Please deliver me, that's all part of your soul. It makes you freeze time, staring in at yourself. It's time to step outside onto the path you once made.
If I say something that somebody one day says is incorrect, it's not on purpose. I think I make up half of my past nowadays. I don't know how people write autobiographies, but I digress. Yeah, I write comics because I love comics. I've read them since I was a kid. My gateway into comics actually was the Superman movies starring Christopher Reeve. I saw them on ABC. They used to show movies on Sunday nights, and they just captured my imagination, and I started watching cartoons, and I found out, oh, this, you know, these characters come from comics. And my late father, he was a comic collector when he was younger, and so I think that was kind of a way that we bonded a little bit. And it also, my mom was happy because it got me reading, which I've, you know, never stopped. I love reading. And so I don't know, Superman, my mom and dad created a monster, and I've loved comics, and I'm going to be 40 this year, and I don't see myself outgrowing them. Which I know is an antiquated thought because their comics are for all ages, which also means adults. And anyway, so yeah, I've always loved being a reader, and to me it seemed kind of like a pipe dream to work in them. Like, I thought there's like a Marvel bullpen and a DC bullpen in New York, and I grew up in Ohio, so it's like, how am I ever going to actually create these books? But, you know, about 13 or so years ago, 12 years ago, I don't know, when I moved to LA and I knew some artists and writers and started hanging out at Meltdown Comics and met a guy who was putting together an anthology and kind of eased my way into comics that way. I started off helping out editing some anthologies and then contributing to them. I met my friend and co-writer Adam P. Nave via a humor magazine called Tastes Like Chicken magazine, which I found at a local comic shop when I first moved to LA, called Heidi Ho. He wrote something I thought was hilarious. I liked writing humor, so I, you know, submitted some stuff to them. You know, they were interested. They introduced me to the staff. Adam was one of them, and said, "Hey, let's co-write something." He's like really friendly. It's all over email. And actually, the book ended up ending before my stuff got published. So I feel like maybe I cursed too much Coffee Man magazine. But anyway, since then, Adam and I just kept working together and writing together. And the first book, like kind of full-length comic we did was Amelia Cole, which started from Monkey Brain, and then IDW did the trades. And then that led to me doing The Bigger Bang and The Biggest Bang, and Adam and I collaborating with artists like Nick Brokenshire and Robert Love on Never Ending. And it all kind of coalesced, and everything led to another thing. My editing anthologies led me to meeting awesome artists like Vasily Godzillas, who draws The Bigger Bang and Biggest Bang, and the aforementioned Robert Love, who did Never Ending. And then through a friend of a friend, or we met Nick through a friend of ours. And yeah, it's all kind of like converged into the Once and Future Queen, which is like, you know, the 31st full-length comic that Adam, Nick, and I have worked on together. And the first issue it has like 5 years of history behind it. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, I love working on comics. I love rambling about working on comics. And I wish I could work on comics full time, because it's a dream come true.
Yeah.
What was I talking about?
I got into comics similar to you, too, because, like, I didn't jump straight into comics. I got interested, I don't know if you remember an old TV show called Electric Company on PBS.
Oh, yeah, with Spider-Man, like, yeah. Swing his arm around, yeah.
Yeah, seeing Spider-Man on that's what got me interested in comics at the time, and it's interesting that neither one of us went straight to comics. We found it through something else and stuff. Were you educated in writing or any creative arts?
I always liked writing. Like, just I remember in grade school, we had a class, and my teacher, I'm still having a bad memory, but her name was Mrs. Smith. I'm so glad I remember. She's a really nice lady, and she, you know, gave us like a writing assignment. We had to write like one page, and I ended up writing two, and everybody was confused. Like, why did you write more than you had to? But I found I was having a lot of fun doing it, and yeah, so I've always liked writing. I mean, that's grade school. And then when I went to college, I majored in fine arts, which is like it was like 50% theater, 50% art, which meant I've always lacked well-paying jobs. But I never used my degree for work. But in that, like I took some writing classes, creative writing classes and everything in college. I like it. I like going with my gut, but I do like, you know, the form of it, some of the teachings. Last year I read Stephen King's On Writing for the first time, and I think it's my favorite Stephen King book.
Yeah, actually, I feel the same way about that book. I tell people that, and they think it's strange that it's my favorite book of his.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, I read stuff of his I shouldn't have read, and I appreciated the fact that he writes more novels than I read, which is, he's fascinating. But yeah, I like reading about the craft of writing, or I like different creators hearing how they do it, or how, like, you know, Adam and I, we write differently, and then when we write together, it's like a whole other creature. But I've learned a lot from him. So it's just fun, you know, and we all learn by reading, and just how we tell stories verbally informs how we write them. So yeah, man, life's a class. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Sorry. Yeah, so yeah, I've had a little. I took some classes, a little formal training here and there, and now it's just kind of going with it and learning. Man, I was actually over the weekend, Brian. We were putting together the Amelia Cole Omnibus, which IDW is going to be putting out. It collects like every issue of Amelia Cole in one book. Oh, cool. Yeah, but as you know, having to reread it and like just look for typos that we missed and just, you know, just making sure everything was in order and all the pages were right, et cetera, et cetera. And to read that first issue and the first few story arcs, you know, holy crap, we've learned a lot. I mean, I love Amelia Cole as a character and I had a lot of fun, but it's kind of great to see how far we've come, and it's exciting to see how far we will continue going as we continue writing comics.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience that I'm taking a lot of my old stuff and adapting it for audio now. Mm-hmm. A lot of my prose writing, and a lot of it, like, I'm editing some of it for clarity, but a lot of it, I actually don't want to change in a way because I'm like, lessons learned, I can see progress from it and stuff, and I love looking back. Like, I thought I wouldn't like it, but I actually have enjoyed it.
Well, that's a healthy way to look at it, because the other way, and it, I mean, of course, you know, he's a hero to everybody and a champion, but, you know, and George Lucas, you know, when he went back and kept fiddling with Star Wars, and I mean, I hated that he did that. Like, I want those original versions that I saw, but I get the temptation, man, because, like, I kept talking to Adam, and just like, man, like, Amelia Cole, like, there's a lot that I would change now, but, you know, it's right, you're right, I think, and this is what this omnibus is, it's, you know, this is how these books came out. You know, I know that Nick would like to redraw a lot of it too, but I'm like, no, this is cool to see your development. And so, yeah, it's interesting. It's sometimes painful, but I think, you know, at least we're looking back and realizing we've gotten better. Because I think, yeah, the negative thing would be to look back and go, oh, I used to be better.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you're worried. But yeah, if you continue moving forward, it's great. And as a reader too, like I always, if I buy someone's work, I want to see where they came from. Or I remember Mike Mignola was at a signing at the shop I like in Culver City called The Comic Bug. And I wanted to get the library edition of one of the Hellboys because they're just so darn pretty. And I figured I'd get the first one. And he kind of was like, no, get the third one. That's when I started knowing what I was doing or something. I'm paraphrasing what he said, but I'm like, no. I mean, number one, he's always been awesome. But it's funny, even creators like him and George Lucas, like, they look back and kind of almost cringe at their old stuff. But I love seeing development of creators.
Yeah,
and we're all hard on ourselves and anybody else's anyway, I think.
Yeah, you brought up the George Lucas thing. One of the things I was tempted to do is go back and drop hints about future stories. But then I was like, oh, no, that's going to open up a Pandora's box. Of
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'll never stop. And then, you know, when are you going to write new stuff? Yeah, it's interesting looking back. Whew.
Yeah, I remember Mike Mignola, like, the first time I seen his artwork was actually, he was doing covers for reprints of classic X-Men books was the first time I seen his artwork.
Yeah. I think, wasn't it called, like, Classic X-Men or X-Men Classic or something?
Yeah. I remember that.
No, his style's changed a lot, but it was always interesting.
Yeah.
There's a book called Gotham by Gaslight. Have you ever read that?
I love that book.
Elseworlds, yeah. It's beautiful, and it's cool how thin his lines are than how he got more into the solid blocks. Anyway, I love Mike Mignola, but I did kind of appreciate how he's, you know, even he, to me, has always been great, kind of looks back and, you know, cringes a little. It's fun to kind of find something to relate to with creators you really appreciate.
Do you find artists as a writer that they can influence you in different ways that maybe another writer doesn't do?
I mean, I don't know if other writers don't influence me, but I will say, yeah, 100% artists influence writers and me as a writer. And a big part of it's collaboration. Like, the way I wrote The Bigger Bang and The Biggest Bang for Vasilius couldn't be more different than the way Adam and I write Amelia Cole and Once a Future Queen for Nick, or the way we wrote Never Ending for Robert Love. Like, yeah, you've got to cater to your artists. I mean, I don't know, like, kind of finding their strengths. Also just finding out what they enjoy, because they spend so much time, even the fastest artists spend so much time, you know, either at the tablet or at the, you know, desk with the paper, however they draw. It's just a lot of time doing it, and you want to make sure they're having fun. I'd hate to think that, like, a writer would read a script that I wrote or co-wrote and rolled his eyes, or, you know, kind of sighed, and, you know, she was like, oh God, I don't want to draw this. I like to think that we can write fun stuff. So yeah, so that influences. And also, when you find out what an artist is capable of, which is another thing, like, when we started Amelia Cole, we didn't really know Nick, and quickly learned that, you know, he could do really complicated, cool action and keep it clear for the reader, and that really opened us up to the way we write. Or even now with Once in Future Queen, you know, Amelia Cole was digital first via Monkey Brain, so we couldn't do 2-page spreads. And as we're, like, almost done with this first Once a Future Queen miniseries, Nick mentioned that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. So thanks to him, on the fifth issue, there's going to be an awesome, like, giant 2-page action spread where he gets to really spread his wings and do something he's never done. So, yeah, definitely, the way one collaborates, or the way one writes, has so much to do with their collaborators, you know, writers and artists alike. It's part of the fun of comics.
Since y'all been working together for so long, do you find that y'all don't have to go into as much detail with him with stuff, that he'll just understand where you're going? Or do you still have to – there's no shorthand?
Oh, there's definitely a shorthand. I mean, there's a level of trust. And also there's, you know, just like if you read something and think, you know, maybe I can combine these two panels, or this one panel should be a couple panels, or I'll move this here. You know, we trust them to do it. Occasionally, if it's a big deal, you know, he'll mention it first and we'll discuss. But usually if he makes a change – you know, we're like, yeah, it's better. He knows what he's doing. But, you know, there's a negative to it, which Adam and I have kind of realized, and it was pointed out by our editor, Chantal LaRocque, for the Once and Future Queen. Like, looking at the script, she'd say, well, you got to mention, like, maybe go into a little more detail of the action here, like what time of day it is or the location. And we've been working with Nick for so long that we kind of sometimes would take stuff for granted. And it's like, no, just, you know, I mean, you know, he can change stuff, and we do have a shorthand, but we still need to be specific when necessary, you know, kind of pay more attention to that. So there's a give and take and an ebb and flow. But, yeah, definitely working with him has been one of the highlights of making comics. And, we all, the three of us, definitely do have a little bit of a shorthand. And then our letterer on the book, Frank Svetkovic, who has lettered The Bigger Bang and The Biggest Bang and some other stuff with us, you know, he can bring stuff to the table or mention, you know, dialogue if it's too long or maybe could be rearranged. Or even story-wise, there's a couple characters who, you know, he read their exchange and had some suggestions that helped us and kind of helped us with quality control. It's cool. Yeah, just the more you work with people, the more comfortable you all get. And in the end, we're all just working towards making the book better.
I think,
so, yeah, shorthand develops.
I think some listeners might find it interesting to know the process that you two do the work together. Does one take a shot at a draft of the script and then the other one rewrites? Or how do y'all work it out?
It's pretty – I mean, sometimes when I explain it, I think I do it in a convoluted way, but it's simple. We when we're coming up with, you know, just a, you know, working out an idea or a general arc, it's usually over the phone. When Adam and I first started writing together, I was in – and still am in the Los Angeles area, and he was in New York. Now he's in Portland, but we're still – you know, we can't go hang out, you know, go to each other's house and write together. So we talk over the phone. We come up with, like, the idea and the general arc. And then one of us, and we always just kind of flip it, one of us will take that general arc and make like a beat pass, like a super general beat pass for the series, and then the other one will do a more detailed pass of the first issue, and then we'll flip it and the other one will do the script for that issue. And then, you know, so for each issue, like I'll do a beat pass and he'll do the script and then I'll revise the script. And then for the next issue, he'll do the beat pass and I'll do the script and he'll revise the script. And we keep doing that. And then we revise as we go on. Like we even, like with Once a Creature Queen, we've written all five issues, but then when Nick draws it, we'll look at his art and we'll have to do a, you know, lettering pass just in case things have changed. And even after it's all lettered, we'll go through and do revisions, you know, seeing how it looks with the art. So by the end, I mean, what Adam and I joke about is like sometimes we aren't 100% sure who wrote what originally, you know, which is kind of fun. Or like he'll compliment me on a line of dialogue and I'll have to go, wait, no, you wrote that. So we like to basically mix and match it so much that we don't want to get precious over it, you know, like. And sometimes I think because I have like a low self-esteem, I'll be like, oh, that was my idea. It's like, TJ, shut up. Like, who cares? Like, we did it together. And that's, you know, that's part of the fun of it is we want like every plot point, every line of dialogue, everything to be both of us. We don't want to like have ownership over any of it individually, because then that kind of takes away from like I like to imagine there are three writers. There's Adam Pinay's a writer, DJ Kirkbride's a writer, and then Adam Pinay and DJ Kirkbride are a writer. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
So we try to have our hands involved in everything.
I don't know if
every comma.
I don't know if you're that familiar with when DC did the 52 series.
I think
they had like eight writers on that working on it at once, and like reading about that, I'm like, that had to be in like chaos to work on.
Yeah, no, it sounds insane. I remember reading about it. I think Keith Giffen kind of like did the basic plot and kind of and breakdowns to try to tie all those together. But yeah, one of the things I liked reading, I think it was an interview with Grant Morrison, where, cause I know he worked on it and Mark Waid, I'm not sure who else was it. Jeff Johns probably too.
Yeah, I think so.
And I remember Grant Morrison saying, cause you know, Grant Morrison is like the far out kind of mystical superhero writer. And then everyone looks at Mark Waid as more of the traditional Silver Age writer, and what I love Grant saying was that people would, you know, make the wrong assumptions. Like sometimes, like the weirdest, most far out, wacky stuff was from Mark Waid, and that's kind of fun to see, you know. When you write with somebody, you're influenced by them. But I have no idea how to do that. Like really, my co-writing pretty much is just with Adam. I don't know how well I would do with other people, but yeah, something like that. That's still amazing that happened and worked out as well as it did, huh? Those writers working together.
Yeah, I think they showed that was like a unique thing, because I think DC tried to do a similar thing right after that with the Countdown series, and it seemed to not as worked as well.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, lightning doesn't always strike twice, that's for sure.
A thing that I've heard some people talk about before with writing for comics is, how do you deal with, like, the dialogue for a book, because do you write it all out in your original script and then edit towards how much space you might need, or working with a letterer to find out how much space you would need?
You know, I do it different ways. Normally, and the way I prefer to do it is to, like, you know, write a full script, you know, page one, panel one, description of the action in the panel and the location and then the dialogue, so that the artist also kind of, and the dialogue's always subject to change, but, you know, it's good for the artist to see, like, who's talking first and how much text there is or might be, so, you know, the he or she knows how much space to leave, you know, in the panel for dialogue. So that's how I prefer to do it, and it's always flexible, and, yeah, letters always have good suggestions, editors, and I find that usually you can cut a lot, you know, once you see the art, too, because it's a visual medium, and you don't usually, ideally, you won't have to explain so much. But then, like, with the Bigger Bang, Vasily wanted a lot more flexibility, and so I would write a story, and, like, and subtly, like, I didn't tell him this, but instead of, like, doing, like, panel one or panel two, I just, like, make paragraphs and then, like, maybe sample dialogue or, like, kind of what the character – I want the characters to get across. And then when I saw what he drew, then I'd go back and basically script the issue because it's often very different. But then it became, like, its own unique thing that neither of us would have done solo. And I remember actually with the – both Bigger Bang and Biggest Bang rewriting a lot after they are. And then even like the first couple issues, Frank lettered and we still rewrote and he relettered because then it became like, you know, how much is too much and what does the art really need and when should I pull back? And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm babbling because it's just always different.
Yeah. Like, I
it's
remember
just always.
When I was in college, I did as a lot of people do, like, I did with a bunch of artists, we would do, like, single-issue books and put them out every so often locally. And I remember the first book I ever did, I handed it to an artist, and he looked at me, and he's like, this is not a novel, I can't put all that.
Right. Oh, yeah, right, yeah, that's what you think. Or a lot of writers will accidentally put multiple actions in one panel. It's like, no, you got to remember, this is a still picture. You know, like the character's either going to reach for the phone or pick up the phone or have the phone, you know, by his head, but he can't do all three in one panel, you know, comfortably.
Yeah.
So that, like, yeah, that's an interesting thing.
Like, my writing training is actually in film scripts. So I remember the process of learning, like, how much time is representative towards a page and working from that and learning that process. Is that a hard process to learn with comics when you have to learn, like, how many panels to fit and how much action to fit in a given page to make it work?
Oh, definitely. I think that when I first started, when Adam and I first started working together, too, there's a little short story that I think is really fun that we did in Pop Gun Volume 3 with Matteo Scalera back, like, before he started doing Black Science and Marvel work and became, like, a superstar. But yeah, it was really fun and really cartoony, but looking back at that, we crammed way too much. I mean, he drew it and he rocked it. It's really funny to me and he did a great job, but if I could have gone back, I think, like, it was like a 6-page short that with the amount of action and script we had should have been 12 pages. And but that was like kind of a learning experience. And yeah, and then also every artist is different. Like, I think Nick was one of the few artists where we, you know, write maybe be like, oh, you know, can we, you know, cram 6 panels onto this page? And he'd end up doing 11, you know, because in Breaking Down, there's like one action scene in the first volume of Amelia where that's when, like, we both were like, holy crap, this guy, he can do whatever. He can, you know, he's good to go. Like, we don't have to worry anymore. But or then there's like Robert Love. He draws really big, powerful superhero stuff, and I don't want to give him more than 5 panels a page. And then with Vasily, half the time it is what's he going to do? And then I figure it out. You know, so every artist is different, and that's kind of fun. So it's hard to have a hard and fast rule about it.
When you, like, talking about every artist being different, how is that, like, filling out process work when you first start working with the artist? Is it basically like the first issue, or is it when you may work on designs for the book, or?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I hate to keep saying it's always different, but it is. I think that, I mean, sometimes I'll have something already written and then give it to an artist. And but yeah, I think it's important for the writers and artists to communicate before drawing's even done, or before writing's even done, if possible. But and I'm not as good at that as I should be, and I need to get better at that. Because, yeah, it's good to kind of feel it out and see what they like. Like, you know, kind of like once I realized what Vasily was looking for, working on comics with him was better for both of us, you know? Or with everybody, not just, I mean, yeah, like with Nick, like realizing, you know, how he worked once we finally did. So it did, like, I remember my wife's, when she first read Amelia Cole said she felt like we hit our stride with issue 3. And I think she's being generous, because I think we, like, hit our stride with book 3. But anyway, yeah, it's like, it's funny. It's fun to see it develop. And that's the thing, too, with a monthly comic or something. Same with, like, TV shows. Like, when you watch a pilot episode of a show, usually that's one of the worst episodes. Because they're feeling their way through the actors are learning the characters and the directors are learning, just like the artist is learning how he wants to draw the characters and the writers were learning how to work with the artists and the voices and everything. So usually it takes a while. And one of the things that's kind of cool with Once and Future Queen is that, you know, we've all worked together before, and instead of like where Amelia Cole number one was our first comic together ever and reads like it. Once a Future Queen number one is our 31st, and there's a big difference there. So that's one where, like, I feel like we kind of were able to hit the ground running right off the bat, and that's pretty cool. But it's almost like Queen had an unfair advantage over Amelia.
Yeah, it's almost like raising the second or third kid, you know?
Oh, yeah, right? I mean, yeah, exactly. So my brother and sister are better people than I am. No, I'm just kidding.
One of the things I liked about the first issue is how it, some books tend to not tell you much at all, or they tell you too much. I thought y'all did a good job of balancing, like, the story gets on, it doesn't hang around, but you don't, like, rush it, or you don't leave people with nothing happening. Was that a hard thing to do for a first issue?
Yeah, no, thanks, I'm glad you think that, and I appreciate you saying that, because some of the, I feel like, you know, the people, it's kind of a more, I don't want to say old school, but kind of a more old school way of writing. Like, comics used, like, a lot of stuff used to happen in an issue. It's more compressed storytelling, whereas now the, you know, decompression is what we always hear about. And both can work for a comic, and skilled creators can do either. And just Adam and I, and I think Nick too, we want to make sure there's action in every issue. I think we definitely wanted Ronnie, the lead character, to get Excalibur in the issue, not like, whereas we could have, you know, like it could be a few issues in before she finds out what's going on and meets her enemies and everything, and that would have worked too. And we have gotten some criticism for, you know, some people say we crammed too much in the issue, whereas then we've had other people say, like, oh man, you know, they liked that, the, you know, because comics are $3.99 for 22 pages, like, we wanted to make sure people got their money's worth. And also, you know, this is a 5-issue miniseries, and we hope to do more, but there's no guarantees, so we want to make sure we can tell the story, a whole story in 5 issues. You know, we don't have the luxury of maybe an open-ended, ongoing series yet, you know, so, and that all factored in. But I'm glad that we hit kind of the sweet spot for you. That's what we were shooting for. We wanted just to, you know, get the intros going, and still there's more to learn with each issue, but yeah, we just like to make sure that if people pluck down, like, you know, $4, that they're getting their money's worth.
Yeah, I mean, you could have stretched things out. I mean, heck, you could have had a whole 5-issue series with her finding the sword at the end if you wanted to.
Like, 100%, and it could have been great. And, you know, yeah. Sometimes I do, I second guess and third guess and fourth guess. And, you know, like when Adam and I work together, it is different than when we work solo. So I don't know how either of us would have done it solo. But together, yeah, it just felt like this was the pace we wanted to go. You know, we didn't want the scenes to run too long, and, you know, and comics are different than movies too. I mean, a lot of writers do great long dialogue scenes, and we actually have one coming up where it's, you know, a couple pages of dialogue, and it's great. But I feel like writing a comic is very different than writing a TV show or a movie, and it's about kind of getting the feeling and getting the characters across, but letting the art take over. And then, like, you know, if there's like a movie version or a TV version someday of this, you know, at the time, the pacing will be very different. But this felt like a very kind of fun way of doing a comic booky pacing.
Yep, especially for a first issue, because, like, you, like, if you'd waited and not revealed as much, you might not get people buying a second issue. They may have felt like, well, this story's not going anywhere. So you almost today, with the people waiting for trades or waiting for later, you might not have people coming back for a next issue unless you hook them with that first issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fear too. Yeah, so we want to make sure, yeah, they're hooked. And Like, and we end it in the middle of a fight scene, actually, which is an action scene, which is kind of odd. But yeah, we wanted to make sure we had action in there. And then, yeah, we wanted people to have a reason to come back. So, like, we want to, you know, tell you, let you know what's going on, but also have a lot of unanswered questions and some hints to keep you going and keep you coming back. Because you're right, because they're just, Brian, you know, as you know, too, like, there's just so many awesome comics out there as well. And some writers, if they're really established or you know, comic book, you know, are famous, you know, they have the luxury of maybe taking their time and readers will trust them. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If I'm reading like a Brian K. Vaughan book or I don't know, I'm just trying, now I'm always blanking when I start talking, or, you know, Neil Gaiman or something, you know, I or Warren Ellis, you know, like, I trust them. If not, if I feel like, oh, you know what, this issue like really eased me into the world, but I know something awesome is coming, and I'm gonna in, you know. But we're definitely not there, and so, yeah, we're also almost in a way playing with like knowing that we don't have the reader's trust, like we have to earn it.
Yeah, and, it's true. It's yeah. Like dealing with property stuff. Like if you're dealing with a Superman book or whoever, people are gonna automatically give it a chance. With something like y'all right. doing, even though it's like sort of established characters, folklore characters and such, you really got to get them or they're not going to come back for a second issue.
Right. And that's what we were just trying to find that balance. And just looking into every issue has to end like that. And every issue has to have its own story while adding to the bigger arc. For sure.
Another thing looking at, because I'm looking at the, because when the first time I read it, I read the digital version. And looking at right in front of me now is the paper version, and a thing I've always been interested in is the placement of ads when it comes to storytelling flow. Do y'all have any input on that at all?
We do not. And what's funny, too, is like with you know, trades aren't ads in the middle of the story, throughout the story, and with the Bigger Bang and Biggest Bang, there were no ads at all. So this is one of the first times in a while where you know, it was a little jarring for me, you know, to see ads. Like, my wife jokes, like, she's like, oh, Buffy's in your comic. Because there's, like, a Buffy the Vampire Slayer ad in there. Which is appropriate that there would be a Buffy ad in this comic, I think. But, yeah, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Like yes, it's – no, we don't know where the ads are going to go.
Yeah.
Or what ads are going to be in there usually.
Do you have any idea what page they're going to be on?
Nope.
You don't?
Although, I wonder, though, if we went and looked, maybe we would know. Maybe they're always on the same pages. I really don't know for sure. I mean, the only time it would matter, really matter, is like, you know, like I mentioned the issue 5 two-page spread. Like, we got to make sure. Now, I mean, obviously, like, the less, you know, the even it's going to be an even page and an odd page, so you open it up. But, yeah, that's the only time where, like, you know, obviously Dark Horse would know we can't put an ad to split up this spread. But yeah, it's an interesting thing, and it really it's funny how even though we've been writing for a while and making comics for a while, that's an area where I'm kind of a novice. Like, you know, I haven't had many ads throughout my books. So yeah, that was interesting reading the paper version as well.
Well, I know
seeing the ads.
When I was in school and we would have a project of writing like a TV script, they would tell us like, well, here's your commercial breaks. The teacher
right.
would. But then they would tell us, like, but if this story's in syndication, they're going to cut off, like, automatically syndication, I think, cuts off 10 to 20 minutes of every episode. You can barely
notice. Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to, like, think about that the whole time you're writing scripts and everything else. So I guess it's like people don't understand, like, there's different things that can interrupt the flow of a story that you have no control of.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with comics, thankfully, I mean, there's a lot more to kind of remember, and there are more rules, to be honest, like hard and fast rules, I think, with most, you know, traditional broadcast television writing. But, the one thing that Adam really helped me with when we first started writing together and still does is just remembering the page turn, trying to put a surprise maybe on an even number page or knowing that, you know, you want the reader, you know, like, ideally, like, if there's a big moment, you turn the page and it's, you go, holy crap, as opposed to you're reading the left, you know, the even numbered page on your left side, but peripherally you can see the surprise on the odd number page on the right, like, stuff like that. But, so far there hasn't been, like, a lot of interruption or we haven't had to really think too much about the ads.
That's
but it was interesting to see them.
Yeah, it's interesting the things you gotta think about, like the ads, but it's like the approach to different formats. Like, I think it was Stan Lee that said, it might have been Stan Lee, you never know with Stan when he tells stories, but he was talking about, like, he always started stories in the middle or at the end of another story.
So yeah, it's like, yeah, I think that's a good storytelling technique.
Yeah.
To keep it exciting, like actually when I was in school and we'd talk about, you know, I worked a little bit, like writing in theater or film or TV, like if you have a scene, you don't need to see everybody, like if people are meeting like at a coffee shop, we don't necessarily need to see when everybody arrives and sits down and orders and walks in, and we don't need to watch them usually say goodbye and walk off to their cars. Like you just want to, you know, like, the scene starts when they're there and they're maybe mid conversation and it ends before the conversation kind of peters out and gets boring, right? So yeah, that's the same, you know, with everything. Even like a first issue, there's already stuff going on. Like we, you know, unless you're telling like someone's life story, and you start from birth.
Was y'all tempted to do more in the past with the first issue, or was it automatically you wanted it basically all set in the present?
We wanted it to mostly, you know, be present. I mean, there would be some, you know, definitely we don't discount the past. And, you know, like the Legend of Arthur exists in this world. Like, people know about it. And she knows who Merlin is, even though she's confused as to why he's in a spacesuit and why he's real. But yeah, we kind of like to start stories in the here and now. And if there's a need for a flashback or you know, that'll be cool. I'm not a huge fan of prequels usually either, like the Star Wars. Like I felt like they started right where they should have. I didn't need to know what Anakin was like as a little kid, to be honest, but that's just my opinion. And so, or even with like Amelia Cole, like we literally started the book like in the middle of an action scene and then caught you up as we went along. And with Queen, it's not quite that extreme, but yeah, we wanted to keep it in the present, and if the readers don't know everything yet, neither do the characters, so it's all good.
Yeah, you were talking about earlier with some people commenting about y'all may have put too much. I think that may have been true if y'all had put, like, a bunch of flashbacks in it.
But
because you got it telling her story, it really moved with her the whole time. I don't think it seemed like there's a lot. It was hidden that there was a whole lot of information there.
Right. Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's always a balancing act. And we're always learning. And who knows, like, in 5 years, if we're doing another series, I might look back at, hopefully I'll look back at this book and go, holy crap, we've learned so much. And I would have changed this and that and that. But for right now, it's still new enough that I'm like, I think for right now, where we are as creators, I think we kind of hopefully started in the right place and found the right balance of information and compression and decompression. But it's always a learning process.
I wanted to ask you about how it's going with since the book's been released. I know y'all recently went to a convention. How'd that turn out?
It went really well. The response has actually been, and a lot of, like, in terms of the way the readers who have read it are reacting, I think it's almost as good as I could have hoped for. Yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, it's interesting to have single issues come out. This is the first time the Amelia Cole team has had, like, a single issue on the stands, and we'll have a monthly presence on the stands as opposed to just going digital and then, like, to trade. So I think that's part of why we're getting maybe more of a reaction than we're used to. There's, like, a traditional comic book reader now that is checking out the book. And we have built up a little bit of an audience from Amelia Cole. So, yeah, so far, like, the reviews are all good. I think the feedback I've seen is like a solid B. Like, I don't know that anyone's saying we're a home run, but hopefully by the end of the series, maybe some of the people on the fence will see what we're doing and dig it. Or, you know, I mean, no one's going to like everything. I think that the worst reaction to get is like a meh, which we get. And that's literally, I hate that reaction because I want either, you know, I'd rather someone hate it than kind of shrug at it, right? But so far, so good in terms of overall. I think people enjoy it, and even if it's not their cup of tea, they kind of appreciate it for what it is. And I'm hoping that, like, issue two will get – I know usually there's a reader drop-off, but, my God, I hope that, you know, if the people who are on the fence give issue two a try and then get hooked even more, maybe people hear about what we do in two and three and want to go back and check out issue one. But yeah, so far, like, yeah, at the convention, it was great. We sold a lot of our issues. Dark Horse sold a lot too and was happy with their signing at their booth. And I feel like there's some good excitement building with this book. And I'm hoping that by the end of the miniseries, it'll be worth us doing more. And I show readers really give it a shot and really dig it because we like making it, so I want to make more.
Yeah, I have a friend who owns a comic book shop, one of our local comic book shops down here in Florida, and he tells me that drop off with issue one, there's just so many factors in with it that it could be people who are testing the book and they may love it, but they might say like, I'm going to buy the trade when it comes out now.
Right.
Or
that's true too.
Yeah, or it could be somebody just buying first issues. You just don't know. Like, it's hard to tell if that's any kind of like really judgment of what people are going to love about a book or not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, different. Everybody likes different things, but it is interesting. Yeah, and some people do still have that. Like, they just either want to try the first issues, or I mean, we had some people at the convention, you know, getting a signed issue one, and be like, "Oh, it's going to be a collector's item," and I was kind of laugh. Like, I don't think so. Maybe, but that's definitely not a reason to buy a book. But yeah, that's one of the reasons that number ones always tend to sell the most. Although, like, this is pie in the sky and not going to happen. But you think about something like The Walking Dead, where that first issue, I mean, it's a collector's item now because it was under-ordered. And the book has gotten so much more popular. I mean, that's amazing. That's not going to happen, but like something similar to that would be the dream where this book is discovered and maybe like issue five does sell really well because people have gone back and, you know, and they are missed out on issue one, or the trade does well, but then if we do another miniseries, that'll do better because people discovered it and it kind of started under the radar and then built an audience. I think I'd rather have that than have like huge explosion and then it kind of falls off a steep cliff and does nothing.
Yeah, I remember.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I remember when Walking Dead came out. It wasn't a hit out of the gate, like automatically.
And that builds longevity to me. It's same with like movies now. You know, it used to be like I keep talking about Star Wars, but like that movie was out in theaters for a year or more. I don't know. It's out there for a while, and kind of like word of mouth let it spread and it got bigger and bigger and kept making money. Whereas now, like movies have to make almost all their box office in the first 3 or 4 days, like opening weekend. And that causes us to kind of almost forget about things, too. Like, you see a movie, like, opening weekend, like Logan. Everyone's like, oh, my God, Logan's great, great, great. And now, you know, the next weekend obviously it's a hit, but it's so front-loaded. I love the idea of kind of building and retaining and building an audience and kind of getting people invested in it and having some longevity. Although, I don't know, that might be, aside from some flukes, a thing of the past. I mean, again, the way I look at things, sometimes I'm showing my age.
Well, you
like
had,
in the old days.
Well, you talk about movies. Like, a lot of people don't remember, like, they talk about superhero movies, like the Hulk movies. A lot of people think those weren't successful. Those movies did huge opening weekends, but then they petered out after that.
Right. Or some movies, you know, that's how they look at it and what your measure of success is. Yeah, although, like, even, like, people was talking about Superman Returns. That was, you know, kind of being a bomb or whatever. It was far from a bomb. It made a lot of money, just not enough money. But
well, that movie's tied to. Do you know that movie's tied to like 6 different movie budgets, though?
Well, right, that's the thing too. Like, because yeah. I'm into movies, and especially back then, like it was like, where'd all the money go? Oh, it wasn't necessarily on the screen; it was on a bunch of other versions that never happened. So that was unfair too. But yeah, I do kind of miss the idea of word of mouth helping books grow and movies grow and TV shows. But it's tough, like with comics, it is still, even though the biggest movies are based on comics and there are great shows based on comics, the actual readership for comics is pretty small in the world of entertainment. And then there's so much, like each publisher is doing like 60 to 80 books a month. Like how do you stand out? So that's a challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it is coming out on time, which we try our best to do. Cause you know, if you miss a week that can lose readers, so we try not to do that. I hope the audience grows for Once a Future Queen, because I think the series gets better, and we really want to do more, so fingers crossed.
Being like somebody who's like an independent publisher, I see all my numbers and stuff, And that's bad sometimes, like, you know, seeing every number tick away or not tick away. Do y'all get that stuff? And if you do, do you want to see it?
Well, like with Queen, we asked for it. It's always like, yeah, you want to see it, you don't want to see it. I mean, in the end, for me, I mean, I'd love to make money off a comic someday. But right now, my measure of success, like with this, is as long as we're having fun and as long as the publisher's happy. Like, I don't want Dark Horse to lose money putting out our book. I want them to be happy with how it sells and how much they make, and ideally happy enough to do more. So that's my measure of success. Like, so I always want more, but I'll be like, well, are you guys happy? Okay, if you're happy, cool. You know what I mean? Like, then I have to temper my, like, pie in the sky hopes and dreams, and just if the people actually putting out the book say this is positive, this is good, then okay. As long as they're happy, I'm happy. But of course, I always want more readers.
Well, the one thing about Dark Horse is, like, you really don't see them put out much crap.
No, they're good. I mean, I really like working with them. And when, like, actually visiting their offices and stuff, it's cool to see. Yeah, it's nice to have that Dark Horse logo on the top left corner of our book. It's kind of a badge of honor in a way. Like, oh, they found this worth publishing. That's cool. Yeah, I think it's, as a reader, it's usually a sign of quality too. Like, I'll take a chance on a Dark Horse book because there's a reason they're publishing it.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you look at their books, like, you don't really see, like, something where they're like, oh, this is just a miniseries that's being thrown out there. Like, I don't know the exact numbers, but it just seems like they don't put it out as much as, like, some of the other bigger publishers and stuff. So they're very particular, it seems, with their books.
Well, I hope so. If that's the case, then I'm extra glad to be a part of it.
Did y'all, was this like a book that y'all went straight to them and pitched to them, or was it something y'all were pitching to other people too?
Oh yeah, I mean we had our lists, you know, and it's always a matter of either who's interested or who's the most interested, or you know who you know. But I mean, Dark Horse was at the top because there's just, I mean, you know, there's a nice legacy there, you know, and I do like what they do, and I mean, to have a book that's at the same publisher that, you know, does Hellboy and, you know, did Sin City. And when I discovered Madman Comics, Dark Horse was putting it out. Like, there's, like, kind of like an emotion there, too, you know, to be a part of that. So it is definitely up there. They were on the top of the list, and so I'm really happy that we got with them.
With you and your writing partner, is one of y'all more the humorous writer and one more the action writer? Or is it, like, y'all have specific niches both of you do?
You know, I do think we have different strengths, and, you know, we kind of, because if we were both wrote the exact same way, there'd be no reason to co-write together. So, but no, I mean, like, I think Adam knows, like, Adam hasn't, I don't know, you talk to him, but I mean, he has an interesting past. Like, he knows more about fighting than I do, so one would think that he's a better action writer. But then sometimes, like, I'll write an action scene that, or have an idea for it that just is cool. And same, like, I think, like, I like writing humor and stuff, but so, you know, and dialogue, but so does he. I would say if, like, when I boil down what we both bring to the table, kind of unique to our collaboration, although we've both been learning from each other, I think that he's very intellectual. He's good at plotting, leading from point A to point B, and like creating a puzzle and fitting all the pieces. Whereas I kind of go from the gut sometimes more and more emotional. And so we kind of, you know, there's like almost like, yeah, it's like the intellectual and the emotional, like the kind of, I don't know, he's Spock, I'm Dr. McCoy, and when we co-write together, we make a Kirk, I guess, to put it in Star Trek terms. But we've learned from each other a lot, too. Like, I mean, I've learned a lot about plotting from him, so I know that when I write solo, I kind of incorporate a lot of what I've learned. And there's always exceptions. I mean, it goes back to, like, not comparing us to them, but, like, when Grant Morrison said that sometimes Mark Waid wrote the far-out stuff that people assume Grant wrote, that's the same way with us, like, you know, there might be something that someone knowing Adam's writing would assume that he wrote that I did, or vice versa, or, you know, maybe the initial idea was one of ours and the other took it and ran with it. So, God, I keep rambling, but yeah, I think what it does boil down to is he comes from the brain and I come from the gut.
With the dealing with, like, such a, like, Arthurian legends and stuff, and lately I've been into a big kick on myths and stuff. There's actually a podcast called Myths and Legends, if you ever want to check it out. It's really good. They have actually a lot of Arthurian legends and stuff. I was wondering, what is your favorite myth story?
I don't know. I mean, and that's a hard one to even contemplate. I don't know for sure. I love Excalibur, I love the Round Table, story of King Arthur, but I'm by no means an expert. Like, as a kid, I think what I knew of it was from the Disney Sword in the Stone, and then that crazy John Borman movie Excalibur, which are, you know, very extreme, very different versions, or takes, interpretations. I like those. As a kid, like, I loved Robin Hood. I love Norse and Greek mythology. I mean, I think initially Greek is what most people know, but then because of comics and Thor, I learned more about Norse mythology. So it's all interesting. And I think what's kind of cool is, like, all these myths inform everything, and every tale kind of is informed by what came from the past. And, like, I'm a huge, even though, like, a modern myth to me is like Star Trek, is like they've built a modern mythology, and it's fun to see how like the Knights of the Round Table informed the original Bridge of the Enterprise, you know, stuff like that you don't realize. I don't know. It's just all there. I enjoy a lot of it. I enjoy discovering new things too, or new aspects to myths and legends.
Well, you mentioned my two favorite Arthurian stories, the Sword and the Stone and the Excalibur movie are two of my favorites. And
cool.
And another one of mine is, like, the comic series Camelot 3000.
I was thinking that as you were talking. Yes, I discovered that a little, like, actually after we had talked about Once a Future Queen, I think I found it, like, a great sale at this comic shop I love. I think it was the Manhattan Beach Comic Bug had, like, this awesome sale going on. I found all the issues and read them. Yeah, that's a fun interpretation. And I love, like, seeing interior Brian Boland artwork is a kind of rare treat. And the crazy future, like, 80s future fashion was fun to see. But yeah, that's a cool book. That's a fun series.
With there's been so many different takes on these characters and stuff. Did you read a lot of other stuff before you started this series, or did you mainly just try to go off what you already knew and just write the story from that?
Well, there was a little, like, I did get the Once in Future Queen and read the Sword and the Stone chapter, but there are two more books that are still, like, waiting for me to read. But I don't, like, what we're trying to do is kind of take, like, you know, it's like a jumping off point. And part of it was, like, you know, trying to be good at business. Like, and, you know, like, okay, so what can, you know, Amelia Cole had this big of an audience, but, you know, a lot of times audiences like something familiar, you know, so to have Excalibur there and a little bit of Arthurian legend can be a hook for some people who maybe normally wouldn't give it a shot. But we're not following the beats like a lot of interpretations do. I guess it's a reimagining. Like, that's like the jumping off point, and all the stories you know are true in some way, are myths in some way. And this is just like a whole new version. So I don't need to be an expert to help make this book. Whereas, like, Adam's definitely, he's better read than I am. And then Nick grew up with these legends and like read, you know, like the old versions and the old text. So we have, like, different levels of, like, different expert levels working on this book, you know? And our initial, Hannah Mee Shannon kind of was the person, our first editor, who initially took it to Dark Horse. And, like, she wrote her thesis paper on Arthurian legend. So, you know, like, so we had an expert there. But in the end, we're not trying to follow the beats. And if people think, you know, like, oh, I kind of see where this is going, you know, like, I like Arthur, you know, like, Ronnie's Arthur and Gwen's Guinevere and Lance is Lancelot, obviously, so I know what's going to happen, and they're going to introduce this person and that person. Like, not necessarily, you know. We're playing really fast and loose, because if you know exactly what's going to happen, it's kind of like, what's the point of doing it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we aside from, like, quirky, superficial stuff, that we do have reasons for, like, Merlin dressed like a spaceman. You know, there's stuff like, you know, just the sword actually being in a stone instead of an anvil, you know, like what about the Lady of the Lake? You know, like, there's all these things that, and Morgana and everything, like, we play with it and we do our own versions.
Yeah,
for sure. And so I don't need to do a lot of research. I fear if I did too much, I might be too influenced. And I know that sounds like a cop-out. Maybe I'm a lazy person. But, no, but part of it, too, is, like I know, like, Adam and Nick know a lot more than I do about it. And they'll know. But, like, to have someone who's not quite the expert have an idea that maybe they wouldn't consider. Or if I say something like, oh, that's actually happened in the Legends. You know, it's interesting. It's just good to know and definitely not be beholden to anything while also respecting what came before.
Yeah, and I agree. Like, having somebody who's not as versed as the other people in it might be a good thing, because you might not be drawn to go a certain direction or automatically go in the exact opposite direction. You're just going to say, oh, this might be a good character thing to do, and it might work from that.
Right. I mean, basically, I make my ignorance a strength. It's an American way.
So, to wrap this up, and thanks for agreeing to do this again after the one got lost and stuff.
No, thank you, Brian, and thanks for being patient with me and being a gracious host.
Where can people find you on the internet?
I like to keep it simple, because I myself am simple. My website's djkirkbride.com. I have a writer's page on Facebook that's just djkirkbride.writer. And on Twitter, I'm at djkirkbride. So just using my name. Pretty easy to find.
Well, it seems like all three of y'all are pretty good about, like, everything's easy to find with all y'all.
Yeah, I don't want someone to have to figure out, like, where, you know, there's enough stuff online. It should be easy to find writers and creators you want to find.
Well, I think everybody should check out this book, because I find it really interesting. Even if you're not a huge author fan, I think you'll enjoy it. And, but like I said again, thanks for joining me, and I hope all the issues go well and it turns out to be a huge hit for y'all.
Right on. Thank you so much, Brian. It's great talking to you, and I appreciate the support. And yeah, I hope you keep liking the book.
Okay. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Take care.